10 women would be sent to public places. The chief of the unit says rollerblades make chasing thieves on motorcycles through the city of 20 million much easier.
We felt we needed to come up with some innovative approach to control street crime in Karachi. We analyzed and saw that there are certain spots where crime incidents, say for example mobile snatching, are more frequent. We also saw that criminals use motorcycles that help them run away easily. At times, it is difficult for police teams to chase them from our vehicles.
The unit chief also says that officers would only carry handguns, while in some locations, such as shopping malls, they will not be armed at all. Officers say they can now reach narrow alleys very quickly, where it's usually difficult to go. The rollerblading police are expected to be deployed officially next month.
Niagara Falls on the US-Canada borders is known for its spectacular timeless beauty, attracting tourists, especially during the summer. But this year's frigid temperature has created another spectacular scene at this natural wonder. Visitors to the New York side of the falls were treated with a remarkable view, as stream falling down the Niagara River is now crusted with ice. A rainbow adds more beauty, leading to the most amazing view of the falls. Every day, dozens of people help each other walk across icy stream to take a closer look at the beauty created by the extreme cold weather. More snowfall, low temperature have been predicted for the coming days, meaning people will have more time to enjoy the place.
Iran has inaugurated the Tehran International Tourism and Handicrafts Exhibition according to health protocols. The event is aimed at injecting fresh energy into the tourism industry, which has been badly affected by COVID-19 over the past year. Saman Kujori reports.
Tehran International Tourism and Handicrafts Exhibition has been inaugurated according to health protocols announced by the National Headquarters for Coronavirus Control and following the necessary coordination with the relevant agencies in this field. According to organizers, visiting the exhibition in person will be controlled. Only a specific number of people are allowed to visit each day. Officials and experts believe Iran will achieve a tourism boom after the coronavirus outbreak, believing its impact would be temporary and short-lived for a country that ranked the third fastest-growing tourism destination in 2019.
Although we were under sanctions and at the same time corona pandemic badly affected tourism industry across the country, we have developed and completed many projects in the country during this period. We are very optimistic about the future of tourism industry in Iran because we believe good days are around the corner. Iran is a historically and culturally rich country with abundant attractions.
According to the latest data, 8 million tourists visited the Islamic Republic during the first 10 months of the past Iranian calendar year. Iran ranks first globally in terms of the number of handicraft cities and villages registered by the World Crafts Council. The number of Iranian craft cities and villages stands at 14, while the second place goes to China, which has only 7 craft cities and villages globally registered.
Handicraft exports from Iran before the coronavirus outbreak reached $146 million in the Persian calendar year, which started in March 2019. Iraq and Persian Gulf littoral countries are among the main target markets for Iranian handicrafts.
Under the 2025 Tourism Vision Plan, the country aims to increase the number of tourist arrivals from 4.8 million in 2014 to 20 million in 2025.
Iran's tourism ministry has proposed travel packages under strict health protocols, with the hope of encouraging people to travel and injecting fresh energy to the tourism industry, especially during the upcoming Nowruz holidays. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Feeling frustrated and stressed out, Brazilians have found a place to vent their anger and fury in the newly opened Rage Room. Inside a warehouse on the outskirts of Sao Paulo, people can freely swing giant hammers at old televisions, computers and printers. Demolishing the machines and shattering glass into tiny pieces helps to release their pent-up feelings. The 42-year-old who opened the business a month ago says he has received a fair number of customers wanting to vent, especially during the pandemic.
I think it was the best moment to be able to set this up here. Related to everything that people are going through, a lot of anxiety, stress. Sometimes people miss work or even work a lot at home. I believe this here is like an escape at the moment.
Wearing protective suits and helmets, participants write issues that bother them on the walls, turning the words into targets of their anger. One might think how much it costs to break all these things up. The Rage Room experience, however, costs just less than $5.
Tens of thousands of flamingos have turned the Indian city of Navi Mumbai pink. Bird lovers gathered near a lake to watch the migrating flamingos. Every year, flamingos migrate to Navi Mumbai between October and March. They go there from northern and western parts of India and sometimes as far away as Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Iran. Then they fly out in June. This year and last year, their numbers were much higher. Experts say that is because the lake is cleaner thanks to COVID lockdowns. Well, the world's largest snow maze is once again welcoming visitors in Western Canada, offering them a joyful adventure amid the coronavirus pandemic. The attraction opened in mid-February after being in limbo earlier in the winter due to public health measures and unseasonably warm weather. In addition to the giant maze, there are also snow slides as well as snow buildings and huts with artworks inside so the visitors can enjoy other activities besides getting lost. The massive labyrinth is about 240,000 square feet, twice the size of its record-breaking build in 2019. Designers say the larger layout is a nod to social distancing guidelines.
In 2019, we applied for the title of the world's largest snow maze, which we got in February. And this year, just with COVID and everything, we wanted to make it bigger. And so this year, it's about 91% bigger than the world's largest title that we hold now.
The visitors can only have 5 people in their group, and masks and face coverings are mandatory. Indoor warming areas are closed, and picnic tables are also unavailable due to the pandemic.
Now, after an unprecedented winter storm in some parts of the United States, people in Texas have a rush to rescue sea turtles. The creatures are not used to chilly weather, so they became cold stunned. This is a condition in which sea turtles remain awake but lose the ability to move. Volunteers have so far saved over 4,700 of them off the southern coast of Texas. The rescued turtles were transferred to a convention center and will be freed after the water becomes warmer.
There is a famous quote that love and kindness are never wasted. An Australian couple has proved that this maxim doesn't apply to humans alone. Quincy Jarrett and her partner Matthew have been rescuing animals for the past 10 years and have saved dozens of kangaroos. The couple is volunteers with the New South Wales Wildlife Information Rescue and Education Service. Many of the rescued animals were taken from pouches of their dead mothers after they were hit by cars. Chrissy says caring for distressed kangaroos gives her a kind of sensation she cannot get from anything else.
It was such an eye-opener to learn how very human they were, how emotional, how, you know, interactive. They're not pets, they are wild animals, but they are so amazing to learn about, and that's something that I think wildlife care gives me that I can't get anywhere else.
Once the rescued animals are in a good enough condition, they are set free during a process that is called soft release. That is when the gate is left open so the kangaroos can come and go at will until they feel safe enough to leave for good. Some animals continue to visit their saviors even years after they were released.
If you walk through London these days, you'll spot tiny handmade shops in some places. Let's see what they offer. The shops have been created by an artist to encourage people to donate non-perishable food to charities. Sean Rodrigo makes wooden miniature food banks and puts them in different areas. He uses 3D printer to create his artwork. Rodrigo believes decorated boxes shaped like shops grab people's attention. Each box holds about 35 cans.
How would the Milky Way look like if it fell from the sky? Maybe similar to a magnificent scenery created by the freezing temperature in northeastern China. Frozen waterfalls in China's Jingpo Lake present a stunning view that attracts visitors even during the coldest days of the year. The chilly weather freezes the waterfalls from side to side with thick layers that are up to 15 meters high. The icy layers cover the cliffs, and they are sometimes as wide as 300 meters. But surprisingly, and unlike the waterfalls, the lake itself never freezes and is ice-free all around the year because of its underground hot springs.
Italy witnessed an amazing natural scenery. This one, however, is all about heat and smoke. Footage taken from Italy's Mount Etna shows thick plumes of rose-colored smoke rising into the sky while red lava turning the mountain slope into a glowing river. Europe's tallest active volcano burst into a new eruption earlier this week in the Sicilian town of Catania. Despite a rain of stones and ashes, authorities said the eruption has not been worrying. Mount Etna has erupted frequently in the past 500,000 years. Its last major eruption was back in 1992.
That's a wrap-up. Thank you so much for being with us, and bye-bye.
A diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Despite trillions of dollars in government assistance, about two-thirds of American families that suffered job losses or reduced wages during the pandemic still reported facing serious financial hardship. Many people were struggling and still are just to pay for basic necessities like food and rent. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written jointly by Mary G. Findling and John M. Benson, researchers. This article is published under the heading, COVID aid has been too small to pull millions of American families out of severe hardship. Stay tuned for the details, please. As U.S. Congress prepares another injection of COVID-19 aid for businesses and individuals, there has been debate about whether it's necessary on top of the $3.5 trillion spent so far. President Joe Biden had initially hoped to get bipartisan support for his $1.9 trillion proposal, but the only counteroffer from Republicans was a $600 billion bill, with many in the GOP suggesting more money wasn't needed. The researchers of this article said, "We are public opinion scholars at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. In cooperation with our partners at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and National Public Radio, we conducted a survey in July and August of last year to try to understand how the first round of aid had affected American families in need. What we found shocked us then and feels relevant now as the government negotiates its next steps." The researchers of the article added, despite trillions of dollars in government assistance, about two-thirds of families that suffered job losses or reduced wages during the pandemic still reported facing serious financial hardship. Many people were struggling and still are just to pay for basic necessities like food and rent. Congress passed most of the initial relief in March, including direct payments to qualifying families, expanded unemployment benefits and loans to small businesses that turned into grants if they kept workers on their payroll. By July 1st, when we began our survey, most Americans entitled to a direct check should have received it, and unemployed adults were still receiving supplemental aid of $600 a week on top of state benefits. We wanted to understand the financial burdens experienced by American families that were economically harmed by the coronavirus pandemic, and we wanted to see whether the government aid was helping the people who need it most. The researchers of their survey added, using a nationally representative randomized survey design, we contacted 3,454 adults and asked them about the financial problems facing their households. We focused on the 46% who said they or other adults in their household either lost a job, had to close a business, were furloughed, or had their wages or hours reduced since the start of the coronavirus pandemic. We published our findings in the Economic Affairs Journal Challenge in January. While it seems like a no-brainer that Americans weren't ready for the unexpected employment disruptions caused by the COVID-19 pandemic, it was surprising to us that the federal aid and charitable assistance seemed to be doing so little to support the people it was intended to help. We found that the aid didn't put much of a dent in the financial problems faced by American families earning less than $100,000. Whether because relief was delayed or wasn't spent, the amount wasn't adequate, or the funds never made it to the intended recipients. According to the survey, among American households with employment or wage losses during the pandemic, 87% of those earning less than $30,000 a year and 68% of those earning $30,000 to $99,999 told researchers they were still facing serious financial problems. And more than half of households in these income brackets reported they had already used up all or most of their savings, or they didn't have savings to begin with. That share jumped to over three-quarters for people with incomes under $30,000. Savings take years or decades to accumulate, so it's likely these households are in even worse trouble now. What's more, significantly less aid had been provided from the federal government since researchers conducted their survey. New findings suggest there is a definite need for further government aid on a large scale for tens of millions of families across the U.S. A useful way to think about this is how the government provides relief after a natural disaster. In disasters, cash payments are often sent directly to those in need, like lifeboats launched to rescue people at risk of drowning. And in fact, the pandemic has been an economic disaster for more. Particularly low-income and Black and Latino households more than others. They still need a lifeboat to get them through the storm.
Another controversy for the private U.S. security firm Blackwater. A confidential UN report says Eric Prince, the company's founder and former head, has violated an arms embargo on Libya, by sending mercenaries and weapons to support Libyan renegade general Khalifa Haftar. The report, obtained by the New York Times, details how Mr. Prince, a close ally of former U.S. President Donald Trump, deployed heavily armed foreign troops to eastern Libya to assist Khalifa Haftar in the heat of an attack to capture Tripoli in 2019. According to the UN, the $80 million operation included plans for the mercenaries to assassinate selected Libyan commanders. The report raises questions about possible ties between the operation and the Trump administration. Prince did not cooperate with the UN investigation and has rejected having anything to do with the military operations in Libya. However, the report exposes him to possible UN sanctions.
Well, it's all the same thing, that it broke the law and that he was told to do it. I mean, it doesn't really make much of a difference. In fact, the laws or international law and laws are meaningless to the United States. And in 2011, when the U.S. led the NATO bombing to destroy the Libyan government and the government there, and for regime change, that was against international law, but it didn't mean so. They break international law all the time. When they level sanctions against countries, these are violations of international law. And so, you know, that's it's par for the course. It's very telling, though, that they are that they would be doing this use, having this use of mercenaries.
Since 2014, two rival seats of power have emerged in Libya, namely the internationally recognized government of Prime Minister Fayez al-Sarraj and another group based in the eastern city of Tobruk, supported militarily by Haftar's troops. The damning 120-page UN report on Blackwater's contract in Libya was another instance of military intervention by Washington-linked private security companies in the internal affairs of countries around the world. In recent years, there has been a surge in the activity of guns for hire in countries like Yemen, Nigeria, Ukraine, Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan. Some of the mercenaries have capabilities and equipment on par with elite U.S. troops. But Blackwater is not the only such American firm that is active in conducting high-level overseas operations. Back in May, Venezuela arrested 13 individuals charged with planning an operation in the capital, Caracas, two of whom were American nationals. The U.S. mercenaries admitted that they were arrested during a failed attempt to raid Venezuela's presidential palace and seize President Nicolas Maduro.
We had a casual conversation, I guess you'd call it a verbal contract, giving me some vague mission guidelines on training Venezuelans coming here and putting Maduro on a plane.
The two said they had been working with Jordan Goodrow, an American military veteran who leads a Florida-based security company called Silvercorp USA.
The measures that the United States will take for regime change to advance their interests, very obscene, immoral measures, are revealed all the time. What the reason why they like to use mercenaries in a lot of these things and what they do, and then the academy or this group that used to be Blackwater, is got its notoriety for doing things that gave the United States plausible denial.
The involvement of the U.S.-backed troops in these countries wasn't the first, and certainly won't be the last. But does the growing number of operations indicate that the U.S. is opting for a more indirect means of intervening in other nations' affairs?
Recently published satellite images by the International Panel on Fissile Material have revealed that Israel is expanding its Dimona nuclear facility in the Negev Desert. Israel has acknowledged the existence of the Dimona nuclear reactor, however it neither confirms nor denies the purpose of the facility. The site has provided the Israeli regime with the material needed for its nuclear arsenal, according to a report by a non-profit organization named Federation of American Scientists. In 2020, Israel possesses close to 100 atomic nuclear warheads that are made from plutonium produced in a Dimona heavy water reactor. However, other sources have put that figure at 300, with some estimates even going as far as 400 nuclear warheads. The Israeli regime has a deliberate ambiguity policy on its nuclear arsenal, which means despite being the only possessor of nuclear weapons in West Asia, it always refuses to accept or deny having any. Israel has always turned a deaf ear to international calls on nuclear transparency, and it has never allowed any inspections of its nuclear facilities. With the US's invariable support, the regime has so far defied the international calls to join the Non-Proliferation Treaty, or NPT. The treaty aims to halt the spread of nuclear arms and weapons technology. This is all while Israel has constantly accused the Islamic Republic of Iran of weaponization of its peaceful nuclear program and assassinated several nuclear scientists in recent years. However, Iran has rejected all these accusations, as it was among the first nations to sign the NPT. In January, Iran's permanent representative to Vienna-based international organizations, Kazem Gharibabadi, denounced favoritism towards Israel by the International Atomic Agency. He said such a treatment has given the Israeli regime the audacity to ridicule the watchdog and press ahead with its advancing nuclear weapons program in defiance of international calls. Israel's possession of nuclear warhead poses a significant threat to regional stability. The regime has carried out bombing campaigns against Syria for the past years. It's threatened Iran militarily on numerous occasions. And when it comes to Hezbollah, Israel has repeatedly threatened to destroy the resistance group.
First of all, they want to keep it as secret as possible. But there's another reason for this, and it's because Israel gets a large amount of economic and military aid from the United States. It's the biggest recipient of U.S. aid. And there is a bill that was passed, I guess, 60 years ago, the Symington Amendment, which said that we cannot provide aid to any nation that has a nuclear weapon and is not part of the Non-Proliferation Treaty.
Israel's name has been synonymous with aggression, illegal occupation, and war with regional countries, as well as other international crimes. In August 2018, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu threatened Iran with atomic annihilation, right from the regime's Dimona atomic weapons facility. Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, slammed Netanyahu by calling his statement beyond shameless. The regime is the center of fabrications against Iran's peaceful nuclear energy program, which is subject to round-the-clock monitoring by the UN. Israel has made baseless allegations against Iran, saying it is developing nuclear weapons. Yet the regime owns atomic warheads and refrains from allowing inspections of its facilities. Unlike Iran, Israel has so far refused to join the Non-Proliferation Treaty, whose aim is to prevent the spread of nuclear arms and weapons technology in defiance of international pressure. Several countries have helped out Israel to develop its nuclear arsenal. They have secretly sold the Israeli regime material and expertise to build warheads. These nations include the US, France, Germany, Britain, and even Norway.
Well, you can draw the conclusion that perhaps the United States likes volatile regions. The more death and destruction, the better. It survives on this, and it invests extremely heavily in the most powerful military regime on the planet.
However, Israel's nuclear weapons project would never have succeeded without a major contribution from France. Surprisingly, Paris took the toughest line on counter-proliferation when it came to Iran's peaceful nuclear program, whilst at the same time it helped lay the foundations of the Israeli regime's atomic weapons. Whilst Israel has fabricated accusations against Iran's peaceful nuclear program, it's the only possessor of atomic warheads in the West Asia region. There have been growing calls for a region free of nuclear weapons. So why then have the US and Europe themselves turned a deaf ear to such demands?
US President Joe Biden's administration has announced three symbolic gestures toward Iran in an apparent break with former President Donald Trump's so-called maximum pressure campaign against Tehran. Ned Price, a spokesman for the State Department, said Thursday the Biden administration was willing to meet with Iranian officials and other world powers involved in negotiating the nuclear deal. Price said Washington would accept an invitation from the European Union's top diplomat to attend a meeting aimed to discuss a diplomatic way forward on Iran's nuclear program.
Well, the U.S. is trying to play a little game here by saying I'm going to go to Europe and I'm going to meet Iranians and I want to talk about the JCPOA, and maybe the U.S. will lift some sanctions. It's just the message the U.S. is just not getting it right. The U.S. needs to understand when Iran stopped giving false hope that there is no return to the JCPOA unless the Americans lift all sanctions, apply the lifting of the sanctions, allow Iran to sell its oil and to make deal with other companies as stated in JCPOA, and then Iran will stop withdrawing from the nuclear deal.
Washington says it has lifted travel restrictions on Iranian diplomats accredited to the United Nations, headquartered in New York, limitations that were imposed by Trump in 2019. Also, in a letter to the UN Security Council on behalf of Biden, Acting U.S. Ambassador Richard Mills said the United States has withdrawn three letters from the Trump administration that claimed the U.S. had reimposed U.N. sanctions on the Islamic Republic. Mills said that sanctions measures terminated in Resolution 2231 endorsing the nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, with six world powers, remain terminated. This is while the overwhelming majority of the members in the 15-nation council had described Trump's bid to restore UN embargoes on Iran as illegal, arguing the U.S. was no longer a member of the JCPOA. In a tweet, Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif responded to the U.S. acknowledgement that the snapback mechanism of the JCPOA has not been triggered. He reiterated Iran's position that Washington must lift all sanctions imposed, reimposed, or relabeled under the Trump administration before Tehran reverses its scaleback of the commitments under the nuclear accord. Zarif had earlier urged France, Britain, and Germany, three European signatories to the nuclear agreement, to abandon their calls on Iran to act first to salvage the JCPOA and instead demand an end to the U.S. quote, economic terrorism on Tehran. In a reaction to the U.S. announcement that it would accept the EU's invitation to a meeting of Iran and the P5+1, Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh said P5+1 no longer exists due to Washington's withdrawal from the deal. He repeated Iranian officials' stance that the U.S. must first put its words into action before Tehran follows suit. Even after the U.S. exit from the JCPOA and the reimposition of sanctions, Iran remained fully committed to the accord for a year before gradually reducing its commitments in five steps, citing the failure of the European signatories to the deal to keep their end of the bargain.
Iran made it very clear the government is forced to abide by the decision of the parliament, and the parliament decided to implement several steps, one after the other. The first one is the 21st of February, and on the 21st of February, Iran will withdraw from the voluntary protocol and will reduce the sudden inspection of the atomic energy inspector. Therefore, the Americans need to understand that there are other steps that will follow if the sanctions are not lifted.
The country has times and again noted that all the retaliatory steps are reversible once all signatories honor their obligations.
Myanmar has been the scene of mass demonstrations against junta leaders ever since the February 1 coup. Anti-coup protesters have defied a crackdown by the military, taking to the streets in several cities across the country almost daily. Demonstrators are demanding the release of the country's de facto leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, who was detained along with a number of parliament members. They're also demanding the restoration of civilian rule. Myanmar's junta has ratcheted up security measures to quell anti-coup demonstrations, and the internet in Yangon has been down for several days. Junta leaders deny they staged a coup and justified their power seizure by alleging widespread voter fraud in November elections that Suu Kyi's party won. They also pledged to hold new elections soon. This, however, has failed to calm down the situation.
I guess a lot of times with the Burma army and the Burmese dictators, they are always above the law. So why he doesn't calm the situation is because he doesn't want to calm the situation, because he wants things to be under his control, and he wanted to hold on to the power the way he wants to run the country. And that is why, although you will see a lot of chaotic going on, and you would think that if he is sincere about, if he's talking about the election issues and election is fraud, if that is the case, then why violence?
The army generals have filed multiple charges against the deposed leader, including ignoring an import and export law over walkie-talkies that were found in her home during a search. The Nobel laureate's lawyer says she has also been hit with a second charge, which is violating the country's disaster management law. Observers believe the accusations against Suu Kyi are an indication that the military is seeking a permanent grip on power.
Nobody knows how long the military is going to hold on to the power, but it is very worrisome that they probably may not want to let go the power because for so many reasons, especially those who are in power, like high-ranking position like Mae Aung-le. He has so much political ambition in order to become the president, and even more so in order to control and have control over his own economic ambitions.
The military seizure of power has drawn global reactions. The United Nations has warned the army of several consequences of any harsh response to protesters. The UN Special Rapporteur said Myanmar's generals will be held accountable for any suppression of the civil disobedience campaign there. The coup also drew reactions from other international players. China said the situation in Myanmar is not what Beijing wants to see. It also rejected social media rumors that China was involved in the coup as complete nonsense. However, China, along with Russia, says the coup is Myanmar's internal affair. The United States, however, has taken a different stance. Last Wednesday, U.S. President Joe Biden announced new sanctions on those responsible for the coup and any entities linked to junta leaders. Biden said Washington will be ready to impose additional measures. There is also the risk of a new confrontation between U.S. and China, maybe over Myanmar.
I mean, look, yes, the U.S. is talking about threatening to impose sanctions, targeted sanctions especially. And what did they do in the past week? They did impose some targeted sanctions, but it's just on what, on the gems companies. But the most important thing to follow, to go behind, is the oil and gas company that is owned by the military. That is where they make a whole bunch of money in order to buy their submarines, their warplanes, all kinds of sophisticated weapons, which we call Mag and Mel, the oil company. They didn't do anything about it. That is something we wanted to see the U.S. will sanction.
The two nuclear-armed countries are already facing off on a range of other issues, including the U.S. interference in China's periphery, such as the South China Sea and the Korean Peninsula, as well as the trade and cyber wars between them. Myanmar is just another geopolitical war threat for China and the U.S., but observers believe Beijing has an edge over Washington in this struggle.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
The limelight.
While millions of Texans continued living without safe drinking water and many faced storm damage and massive electricity bills, youth leaders with the Sunrise Movement rallied at the state capitol in Austin, using the current conditions across the Lone Star State to bolster their demand for a Green New Deal. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Jessica Corpett Ryder. This article is published under the heading, As Millions in Texas Lack Safe Water, Sunrise Movement Rallies at State Capitol Demanding Green New Deal. Here's more. While millions of Texans on Monday continued living without safe drinking water and many faced storm damage and massive electricity bills, youth leaders with the Sunrise Movement rallied at the state capitol in Austin, using the current conditions across the Lone Star State to bolster their demand for a Green New Deal. Texas is the perfect example of what happens when politicians cater to fossil fuel executives instead of the young people who have been shouting from the rooftops for years, warning of an impending climate emergency like this, said Sunrise leader Chance Davis in a statement ahead of the rally. The Houston teenager's family moved to Texas in the wake of Hurricane Katrina. I've survived three once-in-a-lifetime storms in my 17 years of life, Davis said. We need change, and the Green New Deal is the obvious, urgent solution. As our communities come together to fill the void of our government, our leaders must invest in us to provide jobs that directly address the crisis we face. The group has been a key proponent of the Green New Deal resolution introduced in 2019 by Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Ed Markey. The recent deadly winter weather, which experts have linked to human-caused climate change, led to major power outages across Texas, the only state that mostly relies on its own electricity grid. Some Republicans, including Texas Governor Greg Abbott, tried to blame renewable energy and warn of the not-yet-implemented Green New Deal, but the outages were largely tied to fossil fuel and nuclear facilities. Though much of the state now has power again, Texans are still dealing with water and food issues. Concerns are also mounting over the hundreds of thousands of pounds of pollutants, including benzene, carbon monoxide, hydrogen sulfide, and sulfur dioxide, that Texas oil refineries released while scrambling to shut down during the storm. Climate campaigners within and beyond Texas have responded to the state's cascading crisis by ramping up their calls for a Green New Deal, which would create millions of jobs by transitioning the nation to 100% clean power, while launching a Second World War-style mobilization to build resiliency against climate change-related disasters. In a petition open for signatures from Texas residents, Sunrise lays out four key demands, including the resignation of Abbott and U.S. Senator Ted Cruz, who came under fire recently for fleeing to Cancun for a vacation as his constituents endured the fallout from the storm during the coronavirus pandemic. Direct immediate relief. We need canceled utility bills, direct cash assistance of $2,000 per month, a rent freeze, and specific support for most marginalized community members. A 100% renewable, resilient energy system and good jobs to build it. A public, well-regulated power system to make a state and country more resilient to future disasters and create good union jobs for the communities. Joe Biden must come to Texas, where Texas leaders have failed Americans. The President of the United States has an opportunity to lead. He must come to Texas and help the suffering and use this moment to take urgent action on the climate crisis and build the resilient power system of the future. The resignation of Greg Abbott and Ted Cruz. Abbott and Senator Cruz have neglected their duty as public servants in the midst of this humanitarian crisis and must step down immediately. They are unfit to serve. Journalist and environmentalist Naomi Klein noted Cruz's attempt defense of the trip in a tweet promoting the Sunrise Rally. Klein, author of This Changes Everything, Capitalism versus the Climate and other books, argued in a column for New York Times that Republicans fear the Green New Deal because it offers a viable alternative to the collapse of a 40-year experiment in free market fundamentalism that Texans are now enduring. The horrors currently unfolding in Texas expose both the reality of the climate crisis and the extreme vulnerability of fossil fuel infrastructure in the face of that crisis, Klein wrote. So, of course, the Green New Deal finds itself under fierce attack because, for the first time in a long time, Republicans face the very thing that they claim to revere but never actually wanted, competition in the battle of ideals. In a statement recently calling on Abbott to resign over his handling of the storm and his lies about the power outages on Fox News, Sunrise Digital Director Paris Moron declared that we deserve a government that addresses our basic needs and protects all of us in the moments of crisis. Despite the lies you will hear from Governor Abbott on Fox News, that's truly what the Green New Deal is all about, said Moron, whose family in Texas lost electricity, had food go bad, and lacked consistent running water. We want to come together and rebuild an era of prosperity through the decade of the Green New Deal.
We'll be right back. What would have happened if Hezbollah had been vanquished? That's perhaps the most significant and upsetting question about the 2006 war.
Much has been said about the 2006 war, about its motives, the behind the scenes, and the circumstances around it, its planning and development, its details and objectives, as well as its outcome and the lessons learned from the war. Also, much speculation has been made about what led to the war. When considering the situation in Lebanon, in the occupying Zionist regime, in Palestine, and in the region, as well as the U.S. role in the war. One of the main issues that needs a close look is what would have happened if the resistance in Lebanon was defeated.
Part 1.
Speaking of a hypothetical defeat would not be possible without examining the history of Arab defeats. Just as one cannot hypothesize about Hezbollah's defeat without taking into account the nature and identity of the supposed winner. There are two other questions that have to be asked. One is, how did Israel overcome the Arabs? And the other is, how did Hezbollah defeat Israel? Only then can one hypothesize about the consequences of a Hezbollah defeat in the 2006 war. In the first two episodes, we will take a stab at the first question: how did Israel overcome the Arabs? This episode deals with the wars between Israel and the Arabs, especially the battle that the Arabs started with a surprise attack. This is a story of two wars in the last century, one in 1948 and the other in 1973, an account unheard of from officers of the classic Arab armies. This story is based on investigations by the military research branch of the Islamic Resistance. Israel's War for Occupation of Palestine, the Great Nakba. One of the oldest known pictures of Palestine, it shows the high walls of Al-Quds and the inner parts of the city. It was taken 111 years before the occupation of Palestine, a valuable piece of evidence that negates the Zionists' claim that the territory they occupied had been uninhabited. Living here for centuries are a people known as Palestinians. This territory has been home to their feasts and celebrations. They have toiled here and cultivated the land. They have picked olives scattered across the hills surrounding Al-Quds. They have collected wheat in Al-Jalil and grown bananas, oranges, and watermelons in Jaffa and Haifa. They have fished with cast nets off the coasts of Palestine to feed their families. These young girls have filled clay jugs with water for men who broke stones to build their houses. This is the story of a nation that lived here for centuries until an obscure foreign regime emerged and began farming on their lands and brought in new people to replace the old nation.
If someone takes a detached view of the region, free from his feelings for his motherland, he would see an Islamic Arabic setting and the Ottoman state that is a great Islamic caliphate. On the other side, he sees a small group of Jews scattered around the world who have been expelled from the entire human society. These Jews came together and said, "We will create our own government." But where? They picked the focal point of attention of different religions in the region. They picked a place which pulses with a history of the great prophets, a highly regarded place at the heart of this Arabic Islamic setting. Therefore, they considered it a success when they established their regime there.
بهذا اللحاظ هذا إنجاز.
In 1837, 110 years before the birth of the Israeli regime, work on the first ever Jewish settlement on Palestinian soil began. An estimated 1,500 Jews lived in Palestine in 1837. The number grew to 10,000 in 3 years and reached 22,000 by 1881. Most of the Jews lived within the Al-Quds territory. Another 25,000 of them arrived in Palestine between 1881 and 1903. In 1910, the Jews established their first plantation in Palestine. Although the plantations were of no economic value, the Jewish movement wanted Jews to work on the agricultural tracts, to tie them to the soil and the land. At the outset of the First World War, the number of Jews had reached 85,000. They possessed some 384 square kilometers of land and around 44 plantations.
The Israelis did not occupy Palestine all at once. They rather seized it by small pieces before fully swallowing it, and it was done through creation of settlements. A settlement is not a housing or residential complex. It is rather a castle with logistical facilities, weapons depots, barracks, and other military features for soldiers, while accommodating them and their families. In a Jewish settlement, people live in well-protected homes inside a castle where they have full access to everything they need, including food, drinks, and items of welfare. This is the full lifestyle of a hybrid society, one that consists of different nationalities and identities that live in the shadow of weapons. Jews got the idea of forming such communities from the Americans and how they dealt with Indians, as well as from the British handling of Africa and India.
During the First World War, the number of the Jews living in Palestine dropped to around 55,000. Many left their promised land for their safer countries of origin. Yet a month after the Balfour Declaration, British forces occupied Palestine. After a long siege, General Allenby finally entered Al-Quds, defended courageously by the Ottoman forces. The first thing the British did after capturing Palestine was they opened the doors to Jewish migrants. In 1919, a wave of Jewish migrants headed back to Palestinian coasts. In less than 30 days, hundreds of ships took 355,000 Jews to Palestine. Subsequently, the Jews used the help of their powerful ally and began to confiscate Palestinian land to build their settlements on. A coastal settlement near Jaffa in Palestine, a settlement that would become the capital city of the new regime. From 1917 on, Palestinians took up arms to defend their lands, and the armed struggle continued until the occupation of Palestine and the foundation of the Zionist regime. They launched a series of armed struggles and movements. One of the rare pictures shows the Palestinian flag bearing a crescent and a cross sign, a flag belonging to the fighters of the 1936 movement that lasted for 3 years before its fighters were suppressed and imprisoned by the British forces. The Palestinian fighters attacked British bases and convoys, and the British torched their crops. 2,000 Palestinians, 200 British troops, and 300 Jews were killed in the 1936 Intifada. Perhaps it is one of the unreported episodes of Palestinian history. In which Palestinian fighters forced Jews out of Al-Quds after a long battle. Pictures show the British-backed Jews leaving Al-Quds. It happened 12 years after the British occupation of Palestine. The Jews' migration to Palestine did not stop. They kept arriving on its shores from Cyprus. Some in broad daylight, and others used the dark cover of the night. It all happened with the support and knowledge of the British colonizers.
They began training Jews, leading to the emergence of gangs such as Argon, Shetron, and Haganah.
I was member of the Haganah Underground Mobilized Unit 41 in helping the British to invade the Lebanon and Syria that were under the Vichy